The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 217.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's live stream. It is Sunday. I'm in Tucson, Arizona, in my hotel room, getting ready to answer your question. I'm super excited. What I wanted to mention right at the top was it's a huge announcement, to say the very least. It's Rebel Capitalist Live. And this isn't something where I'm doing a live stream. It's an actual conference, live, face-to-face, actual human beings interacting with one another. Imagine that in today's day and age. So Rebel Capitalist Live, the investment conference, is going to be June 11th through the 13th in Miami, Florida. It's going to include, well, first of all, the topics of discussion, and our objective is to help you learn more about personal freedom, Plan B, obviously macroeconomics, and better understanding the world around you, and then helping you to become a better investor through the lens of what we're dealing with right now as far as central planning, government intervention, and intervention by the Fed. Said another way, it's helping you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. So that's the objective. It's to help you do those things. And I think the best way to do that is by interacting with real human beings face-to-face. The individuals that you guys recognize from the Rebel Capitalist Show, a lot of them. So who are the speakers that are going to be there? Let me go to the page really quick. And let's see, in no particular order, we have Mike Maloney, Jason Hartman, Mark Moss, Patrick Serezna, Robert Barnes, Brent Johnson, Robert Breedlove, Jeff Snyder, Lynette Zhang, Ken McElroy, Jeff Clark, Adam Taggart, and two people that are going to be speaking via satellite. They will not be there, but they're speaking via satellite, Lynn Alden and Rick Rule. There might be a couple more individuals that we haven't confirmed yet. But that's the main group. So I'm super excited to announce that. For more information on Rebel Capitalist Live, the investment conference, the face-to-face investment conference, go to, what is it? RebelCapitalistLive.com. There he goes. Check it out, RebelCapitalistLive.com. All right, let's get on to your questions. Question, do you have any bug out locations, areas planned that you hop on a jet, bounce for a few months if necessary, with 4 months of food you'll outlive if the grid goes down? Let's see, where you hop on a jet and bounce for a few months if necessary. Well, I'm not sure what problem you're trying to avoid. If you're trying to, you know, somewhere if the grid goes down, or if there's, I was going to say that if the government locks you in your house, but government's already locked you in your house. In many areas, the government is locking you in your house as we speak, and people aren't bugging out. So if 2020 didn't make you bug out, what will? I don't know. I think that's a question that a lot of us need to ask ourselves. I mean, if you're talking about the grid going down, places like Colombia would be great because they grow so much food there of their own. If you're talking about just getting away from a lockdown, but yet we don't have to worry about the grid going out, I mean, St. Bart's is to me the place to go because you're surrounded by billionaires. And one thing I've learned is no matter what billionaires say on CNBC or Bloomberg, what they practice in real life is far different. They don't like masks. They don't like lockdowns. They don't like being forced to stay within the confines of their own home. At least the ones that I met in St. Bart's. So, and they run the island. So if you're looking for a bug out spot, that might be one. As far as in the United States, I mean, I think everyone's got to have an RV. If you don't have an RV right now in the United States, I think you're asking for big problems. Just have an RV parked in your driveway that you can get out to the mountains, just get away from the line of fire. Hopefully, I'm speaking in figurative terms and not in literal terms. We'll see what happens over the next 5 years. But that's kind of where I'd start. While visualizing for success, do you visualize the main end goal or the next immediate goal? How many days it takes from... Oh, no, I don't think about how many days it takes to manifest. No, I think the end goal. You want... A lot of people talk about a visualization board. I think that might be a good idea. I've never tried it, but it seems like it might be a good idea. So I just try to visualize the end goal. And every single day, I just try to ask myself, have I done something today to get me closer to my goal? And is the answer yes or no? So from a standpoint of health, have I done something today to make get me closer to my health objectives? Have I done something, maybe it's from a business, have I done something today to help me achieve my business objectives or whatever the, you know, whatever it is? And every single day, if I'm not doing something to help me get closer to my objectives, I'm not happy. And so, not saying that that's right or wrong, but that's kind of how I do it. Are price controls ever mentioned in any discussion on hyperinflation? Could they happen in the United States? Well, they've already happened in the United States. They happened in the 1970s. And yeah, Russell Napier has talked about this at great length on Macro Voices with my good buddy Eric Townsend. And he suggested that the government will have much more control over the economy in the future. You can see that playing out right now. And they want to control the quantity of money through government spending and therefore restrict the money supply being created or destroyed by the commercial banking system because they don't have complete control over that. So they'll try to limit the ability of the commercial banking system to create money so the government can do it at will and they can create money and spend it on what they deem necessary. And they will combine this with price controls. The government will spend, let's say, $75 trillion on the Green New Deal. And in order to tame the consumer price inflation, they will limit the ability or willingness for the through regulation through the commercial banking system to create more currency units that could exacerbate the problem of consumer price inflation. And while at the same time combining that method, if you want to call it that, with just blatant outright price controls. And he saw that as the most probable future, and I tend to agree with him. Whether we go there directly or we go there after we have a bout of deflation, as far as asset price deflation, I don't know. I don't think it's really likely that we go through consumer price deflation to a significant degree. But asset price deflation in nominal terms for sure, or maybe even in real terms. But then you move into a situation where they're forced to constrict the commercial banking system. And then they also institute those price controls you're referring to. So yeah, definitely it's been talked about and it's something the United States did in the 1970s, which of course made the problem of inflation even worse. All you're doing with price controls is restricting supply. That's all you're doing. It's just government nonsense. Do you agree with the assessment that China's current situation policies will reduce demand for commodities? Maybe, but I mean, where China's policies might reduce demand, I see demand increasing in so many other areas in emerging markets and kind of in the developing world, if you will. But I think you're kind of getting fixated on something that most people get hyper-focused on, which is the demand side of the equation. And I'm assuming, Brendan, you're asking this to try to figure out the price of commodities in the future. But don't forget about the supply side. Demand can go down and prices can still go up if the supply is going down at a faster rate. And so, you know, I was listening to a podcast this afternoon with Grant Williams and Tony Deaton, and it's behind Grant's paywall. And if you're not subscribing to his podcast, what on earth are you doing? It's like 10 bucks a month, but I cannot recommend it enough. I cannot recommend it enough. I think it's just, it's one of those things. It's just like a must subscription if you're interested in macro or investing. And Tony used the analogy of being on a bus and you're driving that bus and the bus is going to a specific location. And if you don't want to go on to that specific location, then fine, just don't get on the bus. And the bus driver needs to maintain focus to get to where the bus is supposed to go. And in the investment world, that bus, or the bus driver, needs to always remember the focus and what the objectives are for the fund or whatever money you're trying to manage. What are the goals? And I think if the goal is to make money, you're gonna have problems, because it's going to force you to worry about price, whether the price of something is going up or down. I know it sounds very counterintuitive, but I say this all the time, and I truly, truly, truly believe this, that most of us would do far better in the long run if we totally ignore price. Just ignore it. Just, is the price going up or down in the future? I don't know, and I don't care. I think I want to encourage all of you to be on the bus that only has one objective, and it's not to make money. The only objective of this bus is to buy things that are cheap and to sell things that are expensive. That's it. Simple. You don't worry about the price. You don't worry about, you know, all these other dynamics. Just, is it cheap or is it expensive? If it's cheap, then buy it. If it's expensive, then sell it. And Tony made another fantastic point. He said the price of something only matters twice. When you buy it and when you sell it, that's it. Other than those two times, the price is irrelevant. And there's such a great lesson in realizing that. And so much of us are looking at our portfolio daily, maybe every half hour, maybe every 5 minutes, and seeing if the number on our screen, I've got my cell phone here, the number, you know, you go over to your app or whatever, let's say the stock app, and you're sitting there seeing if the number is going up or down. Oh my gosh, is the number? I remember a great buddy of mine who I went to college with, and he's like a brother. He's just a retail investor, just a normal kind of guy. And he had most of his net worth tied up in his house. And he would sit there daily and look at Zillow and just hit the refresh button. And sit there. Oh, it texts me. Oh yeah, this is awesome. Dude, my house just went up by $5,000. I just made like $5,000, according to Zillow. Or it goes down. Oh my gosh, it just went down by $5,000. What's going on? I just lost $5,000, according to Zillow. You see, this is, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. It only matters when you buy and when you sell. And if it does matter to you, you're not investing, and you're not doing it the right way. And sooner or later, you're going to get burned because you're too emotionally invested, and you're not buying an asset to own the asset. You're not buying the asset for its ability to pay you in future cash flow. You're just simply buying an asset because you want the price to go up. And it just, I have an edge here because I come from the world of entrepreneurship and just small and mid-sized business, where if I was buying a McDonald's, if I was buying a Circle K or a Quick Trip or something like that, a Mini Mart or a dry cleaner, I would never, you know, they say, George, you want to take a look at this business? I'd say, okay. I wouldn't say, oh, what's the share price of this dry cleaner? I would never say, oh, what? Okay, business broker, what's the trajectory of dry cleaner prices over the last 3 years? Have they been going up or down? I mean, that doesn't even make sense. I would just sit there and say, how much money are they making? And what's their ability to make money into the future? And can I improve that? Can they make more money to pay me more money in the future? Can I get paid to own this more money in the future? Or can I get paid more in the future to own this? It's just, you get my point. You get my point. And it's just, and the irony is that if we can ignore price, and if we can ignore making money and simply focus on the bus that buys things when they're cheap and sells them when they're expensive, ironically enough, over the long run, we're going to make more money. That's my point. It's just like blackjack, same thing. You never, ever, ever focus on making money. You never ever focus on winning or losing a hand ever, ever, ever. You only focus on one thing. That's playing the game correctly. If you play the game correctly, whether you win during that half hour period or you lose, it does not matter. Because as long as you play correctly, you have a mathematical edge. And if you do that over the long run, you're going to win. How do I see royalty stocks in the area of mining and energy as an investment plan? Well, I mean, if they pay you to own them, so that would be an investment. But I would say, you know, they pay me to own them compared to what? It's always a compared to what type question. And that has to do with where your personal expertise is. I think that I'd have to look into them further and see what their valuations are relative to their projected stream of income in the future and their ability to pay you even more, right? I mean, again, I think we have to start with the question of, would you buy the business? Would you buy the business if I told you you couldn't sell it for 50 years? Would you buy it? See, once, if I told you that you can't sell this business for 50 years and you own the entire business, it's a total mind shift. It goes from, okay, is the stock price going to go up, to, okay, I could care less about the stock price. How much am I going to get paid to own this company? What are the cash flows? What is the profit every single year? And is the profit this business is going to pay me, is that profit worth the amount of money that I have to take out of my pocket to buy the business? So I don't know that question, because is the profit worth what you have to take out of your pocket is based on your other opportunities. And that is an expertise question. But I mean, I think just broad stroke, I think that gold is unloved right now. And I think that there could be some opportunity in the space. I've, you know, kind of put some gold miners. I know they're not royalty companies, but I've put some gold miners in the, you know, kind of on the watch list, and just kind of just waiting and to see what happens to the price. And if the price goes down, that would be fantastic. I would like to get involved there, because I think when you look at everything else around, there's some interesting, I'm talking about M2 money supply increasing and the whole market being offsides as far as real interest rates. And who knows what we see in a year, 2 years, the price could continue to go down. But again, that's not really what we're worried about at all. Zero. We're just worried about if it's cheap. And with gold, you got to look at it relative to M2 money supply, I think. And then you got to look at it as far as just for inflation, going back as far as you can go back. But I'd still ask the same questions. You know, would I buy the business right now if I couldn't sell it for 50 years?
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Do I think the lockdowns in Europe are due to the euro falling? Once the euro goes, then goes the dollar? No, I don't. The short answer is no. I don't think there's a correlation there or a causal component. Nickel and copper, I think they're interesting. I don't know about the specific royalties, but I think that nickel and copper, you know, if you believe that we're going to be, that the whole world is going to be driving battery powered cars in 5 years, 10 years, then you gotta own copper. I don't really like it because, you know, I wish it was cheaper. Historically speaking, it's not cheap when you adjust for inflation. Nickel might be a little cheaper. I liked it a lot more in March 2020. let's just put it that way. Yeah, the price could go up, but if, I think there's other areas where I'd invest before I put money to work in nickel and copper. Not to say that I don't like them. How could inflation affect gold and silver in a negative way? Well, I'm assuming you're talking about consumer price inflation. I don't know that if it could affect it in a negative way, unless somehow the Fed raised interest rates above the rate of inflation significantly, which I can't even comprehend. I think the probability of that is extraordinarily low. But, you know, I think the biggest mistake there, Sean, is the assumption that if gold or silver goes up, then you are, or anything for that matter, that you are increasing your purchasing power if it goes up with the rate of inflation. That's not true, because of the tax hit that you take if you go ahead and sell it. And so if it goes up with the rate of inflation and you sell it and you have to pay taxes, then your purchasing power has decreased. It hasn't increased. It's got to go up in excess of the rate of inflation. So, yeah, but I don't think that there's a way that it affects it negatively. Why would anyone in their right mind start a business in the U.S. with all the increasing red tape, taxation, victim mentality from those? I mean, that's a great question. I wouldn't. That's why all my employees are outside of the mainland United States. I don't want to deal with that. And just keep tightening the screws, California. Just keep tightening the screws, Bernie and Biden and Elizabeth Warren, and see what happens. You can sit there and say that entrepreneurs won't leave, but you're kidding yourself. And if your friend and family member Fred believes that entrepreneurs won't leave, just say, well, I know one that left, and his name's George Gammon. And think about all the people that I employed in the United States prior to retiring. You know, over the course of my career, if you want to call it that, it was thousands of people, literally thousands. Think about how many people I employ now in retirement. I mean, I haven't counted lately, but it's through the people I employed and the subcontractors and the people I have working on the YouTube channel and everything I do, just kind of for fun, you're looking at least 25 or 30 people. And I know that's not a lot. And Elizabeth Warren would say, well, screw you. We don't need you anyway, George. But I mean, there's a lot of positive knock-on effects to that small economy that I have created. And if you have 100,000 people that are George Gammons and they're creating those small micro economies, and that adds up. That adds up to a big number as far as GDP. People, individuals, make decisions based on incentives. And you can only push them so far to where they just won't take it anymore. And I know the government likes to believe, and people like to believe, that are in favor of bigger government, that government somehow can create economic growth, or the Fed can somehow create economic growth. What are you talking about? I mean, think that one through. The government can't create economic growth. The only entities, I should say, that can create economic growth is you. That's it. It's you and me, the average Joe and Jane in the real economy. The government, listen, the government needs us far more than we need the government. Individuals create economic growth by getting their butt off the couch, getting out there, taking risk, working their tail off, making sacrifices, and creating businesses that produce goods and services and employ people. Entrepreneurs. That's who's responsible for economic growth. It's not the government. The government can't just magically create this booming economy just through money printing. They need us far more than we need them. In fact, the government is completely dependent upon the entrepreneur. Our entire society is. So if you want to go out there and treat the entrepreneurs like dirt and call them evil capitalists and raise their taxes and increase their regulations, fine. You may have justification for that. But you've got to understand there's a cost-benefit analysis that needs to be done. And you have to understand that you are going to be taking resources away from someone who can use those resources to create productivity and jobs. And you may think that's good, but you still got to do the cost-benefit analysis. You know, on one of my live streams that I did the other day on the Rebel Capitalist channel, I used the example of that microeconomy that I just talked about, and I won't go into it to great extent. But we've got Angie, Joaquin, my designer, my architect in Medellin, that we've got the 20, 30 people that they employ as a result of me bringing them from Ecuador and employing them in Colombia and starting on my real estate projects and continuing to have them work on my real estate project. As a result of me doing that, they're able to employ all these other people that don't work directly for me, that work for Angie and Joaquin. And then on this live stream, I went down the list of all the people that work for me on the YouTube channel, all the people that work for me on the podcast, now all the people that are working for me on this live event, Rebel Capitalist Live. And I went through how I took my savings or part of that to start these businesses. The TV show in Medellin, great example of that. I had to put up money to begin with to start the process. It wasn't free to create a TV show from scratch. Same thing with a YouTube channel. You know, one of the things that gave the YouTube channel a huge edge was that I had these editors right from the get-go. Well, my payroll was like $5,000 to $10,000 a month when the YouTube channel only had like 100 subscribers. So I'm eating $10,000 a month. How did I do that? I did it because I had savings, right? So you look at, you can, and anyone, I don't care how far left you are, you look at the jobs that have been created as a result of what I've done, and you say, well, that's fantastic. Think of all the people that I employ right now in Colombia that fled Venezuela. I have at least 4 or 5 employees, and that's not counting the subs that work for Angie and Joaquin, that are employed and making good money for them that fled the hyperinflation of Venezuela. Would anybody, I don't care what your political beliefs are, say that that's a bad thing? No, they would say that's great. That's fantastic. Okay, well, how would I have done that if Elizabeth Warren would have taxed all that savings I had away from me? Even if I wanted to do it, I couldn't have done it because I wouldn't have the money because Elizabeth Warren would have taxed it and spent it on something else. And maybe she would have spent it on something great. Who knows? But you see, we've got to have this conversation. We've got to do the cost-benefit analysis. Because if you're taking money from people like me, that means you better spend it in a way that's going to produce a lot more jobs than I can. And if we take this to its logical conclusion, the question becomes, can the government spend that money more productively than George Gammon? And I'm just using myself as an example. You know, any entrepreneur, fill in the blank, any successful entrepreneur. And I think the obvious answer is no, not even close. So don't want to go off on a tangent there, but I think that's important that we recognize that. And especially for our friend and family member, Fred, that might be in favor of raising taxes on the rich. What you're doing is raising taxes on George Gammon so he can't employ as many people and he can't create more productivity and more economic growth. With regards to 30-year fixed rate mortgage, put 20% down or pay mortgage insurance? I mean, this is a tough question, Brad, because it all depends on your personal situation and how much income you have. And I mean, you've got to be smart with your LTV, loan to value ratio there. And I mean, if you're talking about $100,000 rental property and you're making $500,000 a year in a secure job, then I would say try to do 10%, try to do 5%. But if you've got a $30,000 a year job and you're buying a $200,000 property and you don't have a lot in savings, then I would, there's no way I'd do 5% down. You know, you want to do 30% down. You want to be extremely safe to make sure you got a good buffer there with your positive cash flow. So it really depends on a lot of different variables. It not only depends on your balance sheet, but it depends on your P&L. If we had true free market capitalism, wouldn't monopolies emerge above what we are seeing today? No. I don't know how this gets perpetuated. I mean, it's a great question and it's such an important topic, but you just have to look at what happens in the real world. And, you know, one thing I would encourage you to do to everyone here, but especially this person is an upgrade that asked the question. Let's go back and listen to the episodes of the Donahue Show. This is for those of you who are my age. I'm 48 years old. I'm sure you remember the Phil Donahue Show, and this is the show that kind of preceded Oprah. It was a daytime talk show, and first thing that will strike you is how high level the conversations were, and how we have devolved into the daytime TV we have now. It's just trash, just absolute garbage. But back in the day, the Phil Donahue Show in the 70s, he would have guests on such as Milton Friedman, Ayn Rand, Ralph Nader. He would have people on that would have very high level intellectual conversation. It was, to me, looking back now, it's shocking compared to what we have on TV, basically the Jerry Springer Show. So anyway, he had Milton Friedman on, and I'd strongly suggest watching those videos, those shows, because it highlights what they were worried about back in the day. And for those of you who know Phil Donahue, he is actually quite a cutaways on the left. Today he'd be considered probably on the right, but back then he was considered on the left. So he would have, and he was a very smart dude, very smart guy, and he'd ask good questions. And so for Milton Friedman, he pretty much asked the same question. But at the time, what was popular was the airlines. He said, listen, if we have a free market, I can't remember the airline he used as an example, like TWA or some airline that was the big main airline. He says, aren't they just going to buy up all the competitors? And then they're going to raise their prices, and we're going to have this big monopoly. We can't allow that to happen, and that's what's going to happen in a free market. And Friedman came back and said, "No, you're actually going to have the opposite. You're going to have more competition." And what's ironic is, if you look at what actually happened in the 1980s, there was a lot of deregulation that allowed for more airlines to come into the space. And whatever airline it was that Phil Donahue thought was going to just monopolize everything, I forgot whether it's TWA, but one thing I know for sure is they don't even exist anymore. They're out of business. So most people that don't have a lot of experience growing businesses, and you hear me emphasize the word growing. It's not just running a business with 5 employees for 15 years. Listen, hats off to you. You got my respect. But there's a lot different level of experience when you start with 5 employees, grow the business to 20, to 50, to 100, to 200. That gives you a whole different worldview. And what you recognize when you've run businesses with 5 employees, and then you've also run businesses with 100 employees, like I have, is you notice that there's pros and cons to both. And it is true that businesses that are these behemoths have a lot more capital to go out there and buy their competitors and to do all these things that you hear about, those people that would preach of the monopoly boogeyman. But what they don't recognize is they've got a lot of, there's pros, but there's a lot of cons. And those small businesses with 5 employees or 10 employees, they have a lot of advantages. The advantages are they're nimble. They can change on a dime. They can turn a corner. They don't have this bureaucracy and these levels of HR that they have to go through just to make a very small decision. It's just, you go to the boss and say, hey, can we do this? Bam, done. That takes months for a huge corporation. And you recognize that when you kind of grow a business, like I'm saying, from 5 employees, let's say 100 employees. There's massive changes at each level. And then the common response is, well, George, they're just going to buy every single one of their competitors. So even if there is a competitor that's kind of a speedboat compared to the Titanic as far as their level of mobility, it doesn't matter because the Titanic is always just going to buy up the little speedboats around them. Not really. And as an example of that, I would say at one point in time, Facebook was a speedboat. At one point in time, Amazon, Netflix, Tesla, every single company that we have today that maybe someone would put into that category of being a big behemoth was a little fish. And they didn't sell. So why should we assume that every single small company is just going to sell out to a big company unless we have these regulations? What you'll find is monopolies are usually impossible without the help of government. They have to have some sort of assistance from government. Like government has to create regulations and all these barriers in order to prevent competition, in order for there to be a monopoly that is sustainable. A great example of this is tobacco. So we go back to the mid-1990s when everyone thought tobacco was going to blow up. And as a result, of course, the tobacco stocks are the best performing stocks in the stock market since the 1990s. But one of the reasons is because the government created all these laws and regulations and all these things about advertising. And the only tobacco companies that could burden the cost were these huge behemoths that were already in existence. So basically what the government did is it didn't protect the consumer. It only protected the monopoly. And therefore you can't have any tobacco companies come in and compete with them because they can't afford all the liability, and they can't afford dealing with the regulations and all the things that go along with, let's say, starting a new tobacco company. And I just use tobacco as an example, but you know, you can fill in the blank for airlines or cars. I mean, Peter Schiff talks about this all the time with starting a brokerage. He says today there's no way he could do it. Absolutely no chance because of the cost of compliance due to the government regulations. It just prohibits any startup from even getting off the ground.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
With the SLR exemption ending in March, do you see the bond sell-off or bank asset sell-off coming in the next 2 weeks as banks adjust to comply? See, there is a lot of confusion around the SLR. And it's really because people don't understand banking, they don't understand money. Not the true definition of money, but what most people, the average Joe and Jane that doesn't watch the George Gammon channel, what they believe is money, and that's the statement in their checking account. You know, they just get a little receipt, or they log into their Bank of America account And if it says they have $20,000, then they believe they have $20,000 of money in their account. And that's just simply not true. The only thing they have is, well, they really have nothing. They just have basically a bank liability. The bank has a liability. You don't really have anything other than the bank telling you they owe you $20,000. But there is no money really other than just cash. There's physical currency, but anything outside of physical currency, it's just a bank liability. That's it. So where am I going with this? Most people that are in, you know, even in the mainstream media and, they've been talking about how the banks will be forced to sell treasuries because treasuries are a component of the denominator for this SLR, this was it supplementary leverage ratio. So since treasuries are a part of the denominator, if they want to increase the ratio, then they're going to need to sell treasuries. Okay. But if they sell the treasuries, then what do they get in return? Well, they get bank reserves. Okay. Well, the problem is that bank reserves are included in the denominator. So why would you sell treasuries? You sell treasuries and it doesn't improve your SLR. It's the exact same because you're just trading treasuries. It's basically like selling treasuries for treasuries. It doesn't do anything to your SLR. See, the confusion that people have is that they would sell treasuries and therefore receive what would be considered cash, right? And therefore that would somehow increase their SLR because it would decrease the denominator because the cash that they would receive isn't a part of the denominator like the bank reserves. But that's a fundamental, in my opinion, that's a fundamental misunderstanding of how the banking system works. And so as proof of this, you can just look at the paper from the Bank of England back in 2014 and through several videos that the Bank of England has done where they show the process of money creation in the real economy. And I actually just went through this with Steve Keen too, by the way, is a few ways, you know, the government can spend it and the Fed can monetize it. We talked about that. The commercial banking system can create a new loan that creates additional money supply, or what is very rarely ever talked about is the commercial banking system or a commercial bank, whatever, can buy can sell an asset, a treasury, let's say, to an entity in the real economy. Okay, so let's think about why that increases or decreases the money supply. Okay, if you're a commercial bank, and let's say you're Wells Fargo, and you've got a customer that is has $100,000 with you, and you sell the customer a treasury worth $100,000. Okay, well, how does the customer pay you? They really don't. The only thing that happens is Wells Fargo goes to their account and reduces the amount in their account from 100,000 down to zero. So they don't really pay Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo just reduces the liability they had or the IOU to that customer from 100,000 down to zero. Are you with me? And the opposite would be true if it says selling the treasury, the entity purchased the treasury. Okay, so if they purchased the treasury, then what happens? then they just increase the liability to that customer from zero or whatever they had in their checking account to $100,000. So in one example, they've decreased the money supply. In another example, they've increased the money supply. They, meaning the commercial banking system, doing a transaction with an entity, whether it's a corporation or an individual, in the real economy. You say, okay, George, so what? I get it. Okay. Well, if the bank is being paid cash, what we would consider to be cash, and let's remember that cash is just a liability of the commercial banking system, then if they're being paid cash, then that would mean that the bank would have to have an account with another bank. So let's just play this out here. So let's just say that Wells Fargo has an account with B of A, and therefore when they sell the treasury, that their account, which would be a liability of B of A, would increase in size by selling it. That's the only way that they could have cash, because anything that's done on the balance sheet of the Fed, those are all bank reserves. That's what the cash is on the Fed's balance sheet, that are assets of the banking system. So the quote unquote cash would have to be a liability of the banking system. If the cash banks have are liabilities of other banks, when they bought and sold assets with individuals or entities in the real economy, it would not affect the money supply. You can just work out the exact same equation, because instead of, while that it is true that if they sold a treasury to an entity, then they would reduce the liability going from the 100,000 down to zero. That's true that it would be reduced, but that liability would just be added somewhere else. You see, because they're getting the cash, and the cash in and of itself is just a liability of the commercial banking system. So you're just taking down the liabilities and then adding them somewhere else. Therefore, the 2014 report from the Bank of England would have to be false. And all these videos the Bank of England has done would have to be completely false. And a lot of other things. If we really wanted to go down deep in the weeds, which I could go there, but I don't think you guys want to do that on this live stream, you'd see how every kind of example that you use points to the fact that the cash banks have are not part of the liabilities of the commercial banking system. The cash that banks have are liabilities of the Federal Reserve. That's it. That's the only place they can have cash is if it's a liability of the Fed. And if it's a liability of the Fed, then unless they've got green pieces of paper, which they don't, it's a bank reserve. And if it's a bank reserve, it's part of that denominator. You see? So that's just a long way of taking you guys through kind of a thought experiment that shows that, in my opinion, and I haven't seen anything to the contrary, there would not be a motivation or an incentive for the banks to sell treasuries for cash, because they're selling them for bank reserves that are part. It's like selling treasuries for treasuries. It doesn't move the needle on the SLR. It's still the exact same. Now, there is an argument for the banks not buying more treasuries, because if they buy more treasuries from the auction, from Yellen, let's say, and then they flip them to the Fed pays for those with newly created bank reserves. Okay. And those bank reserves, or whatever they, those the initial bank reserves that the that the primary dealer banks use to buy the treasuries in the first place go down into the TGA, the Treasury General Account, which is a liability of the Fed. That's the Treasury's cash, right? And remember, there is no cash. There is no money other than the physical stuff. It's all just a liability of either the Fed or the commercial banking system. Okay. So what happens when Janet Yellen spends the money back out into the real economy? Number one, it increases the bank reserves that are circulating on the Fed's balance sheet that are part of the commercial banking system, but it does something else. It increases the money supply, M2, or broad money in the real economy, which is another way of saying it increases the liabilities of the commercial banking system. So how would you reduce your SLR? By adding liabilities. You see? So I do agree that the SLR exemption ending might affect the treasuries, but I don't think it affects the treasury that they currently own. I think it affects their willingness to buy more treasuries in the future and flip them to the Fed, because they know that when the TGA spends it, it's going to increase their liabilities and decrease their SLR. But what happens if they don't buy the treasuries and the treasuries are bought by individuals in the real economy? They're going to be buying them with what? Commercial bank liabilities. So when Janet Yellen spends the money from the TGA, she's going to be increasing M2 money supply or bank liabilities, but the bank liabilities were decreased to begin with. See? If the banks buy the treasuries at auction, then you're increasing the liabilities when Janet Yellen spends the money. But if the private sector does it, then it's a decrease and an increase, which is a net wash. So the banks step back and say, no more. We're not going to do this because we're not increasing our liabilities. We're going to let the money come out of the private sector. Which, if that happens, guess what's going to happen to interest rates? Way up, most likely, right? So then the other thing that that no one's really talking about, that the SLR exemption ending might do, is it'll encourage the banks to take more risk. Because what's the way to increase the SLR? It's either to reduce the liabilities, which we've been talking about, or it's to increase your tier one capital, which is just retained earnings. So you can only do it one of two ways: decrease your liabilities or increase your profit. So I'm sorry for getting so far off track there, but this is a mistake that I really think not just the average Joe and Jane is making, but almost everybody that I see. I don't know that they've really thought this one through as far as the difference between bank reserves and cash. It's just the whole thing. They don't understand how the whole system works. They don't understand how the banking system works. They don't understand how money works. They don't understand cash. They don't understand the fundamental process here. So anyway, guy, just an FYI, I'll be doing a whiteboard video on this on probably Tuesday of this week, because I know it's hard to follow when I'm just saying. I mean, it's easy for me to follow because I just obsess on this stuff, and I think it's fun to figure it out. So I've been thinking about it the last couple of days, so it's easy for me to just kind of rattle it off the top of my head. I understand that it's very difficult to follow. So point is, I'll be doing a whiteboard video on it probably Tuesday. So that'll help you guys follow along, because it's just absolutely crucial that you guys understand how this works. It's not just about the SLR. That's kind of a sideshow. It's more about understanding how the commercial banking system works and how money works. And you guys have to realize that you don't have any money. You don't have money. There's no money. None. Other than just green pieces. If you have a stack of green pieces of paper, then I agree, you have currency. But you don't even have dollars. Like if all you have is a bank account, you don't have dollars. And if you think you do, you don't get it. You don't understand the system. All that's there is a bank liability. That's it. And once it dawns on you that the only thing that most people perceive to be wealth is actually just a bank liability, you start to see the value of things like gold and Bitcoin real damn fast. I guess we'll leave it. Oh, shoot. I got to start another live stream. All right, guys, make sure you check out RebelCapitalistLive.com, the face-to-face. Yes. It's about time that the Rebel Capitalists unite as a community. After what we've dealt with in 2020 and 2021, we can finally come together as a group, meet each other, have a stiff drink together, and learn from the individuals like Mike Maloney and Lynette Zhang and Hartman and Ken McElroy and Brent Johnson and Jeff Snyder and all my buddies that you guys love to listen to on the Rebel Capitalist show. So check out Rebel Capitalist Live. It's very limited space. I had to cap it at 500. And I know that sounds like a lot, but you guys have to keep in mind that there were 400 people that tried to RSVP for my birthday party alone. So we've already got, I just opened it up to the public like 2 days ago, and we've already got like, I think 150 or so people signed up. So if you're thinking about it, make sure you get over there ASAP, rebelcapitalistlive.com. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.